Hi, welcome back. This is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. Right now, this is an introduction to part two of the interview I did with Dr. Artemis Annopoulos. Besides, she has a wonderful name. We all wish we had that. I just can't praise enough the work she's done. And just it's work day after day times time over the last number of decades. She is now has had the most downloaded paper from PubMed in 2021. And she's had the most downloaded paper in 2017 that she put on the year before, 2016. That's incredible by any standard. If you were 20, that's an amazing thing. If you were 40, it's an amazing thing. If you were whatever the age is, it's irrelevant. It's just an outstanding demand for the knowledge that she has to address the situations we are in culturally. This second half of the interview, it gets a little technical and it gets into people that are just outstanding in their morality and their dogged determinedness to research things. And one is a man named Dr. Alex Leaf. He died in 2013. And, you know, I didn't know all these people until I talked to Dr. Sinopoulos, and I had to go back and look these people up. And I wanted to share that with you to get a kind of reference of who this person is. And it's the kind of legacy that she has co-created with other people through the NIH at the time the NIH was what the NIH was doing back then. I'm not going to speak about current situations, but it's about the work of the person, the work of that institution that did pull us forward. And there was a lot of countervailing influences that she had to stand up against. One was the whole bogus studies of that I've already talked about in other podcasts in the they were done in 77, so the late 60s to the mid 70s. One was in Sydney, so it's the Sydney Diet Heart Health Study, and the other is the Minneapolis Heart Study as well. And these came together, and they were the basis for what we now reference as the National Nutritional Guidelines. And she's the one that argued that they should be guidelines and not objectives. And she had to argue that with Senator McGovern. So there's a whole political aspect that existed then that most people don't appreciate. They somehow think it was just on truthful people doing research and putting these things together. But no, there was conflict of interest that were rife from the very beginning. And you had to stand up for what you believed in with enough support that you could be a voice that could be heard. So it's not the naive idea to just stand up. It's like you have to build a coalition of people who believe like you. And she did. And she had a colleague / mentor, I believe, in her reference called Dr. Alex Leaf. And I'd like to read you a little about who he was. His parents were both dentists that, you know, ran away in the early 1920s as adults from Russia, and the whole Russian Revolution, went to Japan and eventually settled in Seattle. And he got his education at the University of Washington, which is interesting because I was in Washington for my naturopathic education in Bastyr, a whole different time, just to throw that I'm familiar with that geography. And then it was a little more innocent time of people doing well. He became a profound influence. But it wasn't just that he was a profound influence as a doctor who was one of the first to be brought into the Academy of Sciences and so on. Let me just jump here. He says Mass General Hospital in Boston was one of the, where he got his, Dr. Leaf's career toggled between pure science research and medical practice, unusual for the medical world. He sustained achievements in both realms, and he was at times chairman of medicine and chief of medical services at Mass General, one of the most premier hospitals in the United States at that time, a preventative medicine at Harvard. And he was one of the first practicing physicians ever to be elected into the National Academy of Sciences in 1972. And so basically from 72 to through the next 40 years, he was of great influence, both in the NIH, and he got involved with WHO and even into climate warming and so on and so forth. All fascinating chapters, but he had the political acumen, he had the morality that of a fair-minded person, and picked people to make his boards. And he worked together with Artemis, Dr. Sinopoulos. And it's just, you have to look at the team around the person. So Dr. Sinopoulos, when we talk about this second half of the interview, she mentions him a couple of times. And I want you to know that he was an outstanding individual in many ways. And I hope that, and I'll put this link about his obituary, which is a summation of, a good summation of his work and who he was. And I'll get a sense of what was going on. So about Dr. Sinopoulos, that she was the researcher, the accumulator, the what's the word I'm looking for? She stood up against really oppositional forces as the food industrial complex was taking form, right? We had World War II, it came in, all this industrialization was new to the United States, and they focused on big ag, right? Big agriculture. And from there, processed foods and so on and so forth, it just lurched forward. And she was of that, saying, wait a minute, we need to, these things are not correct. Let's go back and talk about these, and what a tough time it would be. It's a tough time to be a person of such predisposition today, by the way. And so anyway, I hope you appreciate that. We go deep into the omega-3s and the omega-6s, which is the linoleic acid and the ALA and what they form, and looking at that. So it gets a little technical, but this is meant to be a real conversation. This is probably the only interview I've ever done, and I don't do that many interviews anymore, because I'm not saying people don't impress me, but I mean, she is such a gravitas of work that she personally has done and her contribution. And look where she is. The world is sort of acknowledging, just on a PubMed basis, apart from the WHI is now, WHO is getting involved and having her contribute to the UNESCO encyclopedia. And they're turning a corner quietly, despite all the other issues we have with those institutions. Okay. So, I hope you listen carefully, but this is the first historic. She's of historic importance. And when I say that, it makes it sound that she's old. Well, she has enough years to create that kind of research and familiarity to the subject matter, but I don't want to put her in that category. She is just determined. I mean, she's such a role model, and we don't talk about people as role models because things have changed so quickly. She's transitioned from the 60s of black and white TV, when that was lucky enough to be watched, to here we are now on the internet, and kids just can't get off their iPads and tablets. It's a world that few people have spanned. They're either of that generation and that world and just couldn't make it into the next, but she has. I'm so appreciative of work. And her attitude about, you just have to continue with your truth. And she says, not everybody has access to the truth, and you just have to keep on showing people that in their different contexts, whatever it is that you're talking about. And that's what she had to do. So I hope you listen carefully. Some of it's technical, some of it's historic, and all of it is personally applicable to your own life today. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Right. So what we're talking about is what they call now the Omega Panel, or, you know, the cardiometabolic report, but it's the Omega Panel that has these. You know, one thing that's difficult to test, we're talking about as a physician and a family practice, unless you are very specialized, all of these, except for ALA, is the only one that doesn't come on this panel. I mean, you can get the arachidonic acid and the EPA, DPA, and DHA, and the ratio, of course, and the linolenic. But ALA is the only one that is not included in that panel. Other than that, it's a happy little family. You have all the, and you have the data that is very useful. I don't know why that is, but I'm just saying that's the reality for, you know, when people hear this, they go, great, where do I go get that done? They go, well, actually, that one is a special test, you know, because, so part of me is like, I think people need to know this because it's useful information. And now we're at the area in which, you can ask your doctor, but you can also get this done for yourself, you know, and the onus is on us to understand this, and this is such great, important work, chronology included. What would you say then of, not to jump to labs, but we're there, but what would you say when one has, let's say, a high linoleic acid? They say, oh, well, this person is either a processed fat consumer. Would you say, well, no, let's start with the ratio, look at that first, and then go to linoleic acid and see where that is? I mean, because what I see are not only very bad ratios, that's sort of like kind of the norm today, anywhere from 20 to, we've had some good people down to 5 or 6, that's not bad. They have some work to do, but not much. But you have high, you know, linoleic acid, and you go, and you ask them about processed foods, and they go, "Well, not really. You know, it's I don't pour on the vegetable oil or the corn oil, or whatever." And it's like, where'd that come from?
Well, you know, let me just tell you, because there were studies that were done at the NIH looking at the ratio of various groups. Mm-hmm. And they found out extremely high ratios because these people ate ultra-processed foods, which are having high amounts of omega-6 fatty acids. Mm-hmm. And then they also used sunflower oil in everything that they happened to cook at home. And so they had a very high linoleic acid in their diet. Now, if these people happen to be fast metabolizers, this linoleic acid would be metabolized in higher amounts and faster into arachidonic acid.
Right.
And this high arachidonic acid puts them in a pro-inflammatory state. And you know that because when you measure the arachidonic acid, it is much higher than what you would expect what the average population would be,
right.
Number one.
Right.
Then if you measure interleukin 1 and interleukin 2 and interleukin 6 and tumor necrosis factor, they are all elevated.
Would you put CRP in that?
The what?
Is it CRP, C-reactive protein? I mean, that's a little more of a more common.
Well, the C-reactive protein is definitely increased, but not in all cases. However, in persons where they have their fast metabolizers,
right?
You know, they were able to show in Italy when they did the study that the C-reactive protein increased as the ratio of arachidonic acid to EPA increased. In other words, they measured the arachidonic acid and EPA in the red blood cells membrane phospholipids, and they measured C-reactive protein. And they were able to show the level of C-reactive protein was higher in those that had the higher arachidonic acid to EPA.
Got it.
And they also had a much higher frequency of heart disease.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, this is a very good study, one of the very early ones done, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago.
Yep. Yep.
That they showed that. But the interleukin 1-6 and tumor necrosis factor, people measure them because a lot of women with arthritis have a serious problem. Mm-hmm. Because of the high amounts. I mean, women with rheumatoid arthritis should not be using vegetable oil. They should only use olive oil or the monounsaturated oils made from nuts, such as, for example,
Are you thinking walnut?
I don't know. Well, the thing is that walnut oil has a ratio of 4:1, but it's 80% omega 6. You know, so I would say, you know, hazelnuts, for example, are all monounsaturated. Hazelnut oil is very similar to olive oil.
Where are you on the Can I put in two questions? One is, while we're on arachidonic acid, do you have just in the back of your mind, and feel free to say no, a general percentage of the phospholipids that we should shoot for? Because the problem with labs is that they kind of go to the average, and the average is not necessarily a healthy number to work from. If you don't have it, then that's fine. Does anything ring a bell in the back of your mind about a percentage of arachidonic acid?
Yeah, you have to repeat your question
very
slowly, because you went very fast and I couldn't follow.
Okay, the percentage of arachidonic acid, and so the red blood cell, do you have a number in the back of your mind of what is a good percentage to have? And the reason I ask this is because often when we use labs, you know, as a family physician, that the labs tend to gravitate to the average, not necessarily to, you know, unless they're, you know, the average, like insulin gets to be, you know, way too high, and it gets to be not all that useful, as opposed to...
Yeah. So let me tell you, the way the studies are being done is to see what is the baseline. And I can tell you, the LA can be very high. It can be like 10 to 1, 20 to 1, or 30 to 1, linoleic to alpha-linolenic.
Okay?
So the arachidonic acid will depend whether they are fast metabolizers or not. So you need to measure it and see how it relates to EPA and DHA, and then decide how much EPA and DHA to give to bring it to balance.
Got it. Okay. The other question I had is, we're talking about, you're saying hazelnut is a good monounsaturated fatty acid to use oil. Where are you on the canola thing? I mean, I know canola has kind of become...
Okay. All right. So, linoleic acid, okay, sunflower oil, let's say.
Interferes
with the incorporation of EPA and DHA into the cell membranes. So, which is a very important concept. Monounsaturated oils, olive oil, which has been examined very carefully, does not interfere with the incorporation. In fact, it promotes the incorporation of omega-3 fatty acids into the cell membranes. But the studies that have been done with olive oil are the ones that have evaluated oleic acid, omega-9, and olive oil, don't forget, it contains phenols. And phenols are very anti-inflammatory. So the beneficial effects of olive oil are dependent on its two constituents, oleic acid and phenols.
Got it.
Okay. Now you asked me about canola. Canola, in its natural state, not the one that is has a much lower amount of alpha-linolenic acid. It's, you know, the organic canola oil through press.
Got it.
What you have is a very good oil. And in fact, I use it half olive oil, half canola whenever I cook. When I eat a salad, I use extra virgin olive oil. But when I cook, I use a combination of canola and olive oil. Ideally, I like to use the organic canola.
Okay. Do you have a brand name that you think about? I mean, because that is...
I think, you know, there is one company in California. I think it's called... Malbeans. I can send it to you, actually.
Okay, that's good.
Because they have it in oil. They also have it in capsules.
Okay, that's good.
Because there are people who do take flaxseed oil supplements and canola oil supplements.
Right. And
so now what is going on right now is they are trying to lower the amount of omega-6 in sunflower and safflower and try to pass it as a healthy oil because it has a lower amount of omega-6 than in its natural form.
Right, right.
But I don't know. I don't use any of this. I prefer to use the olive oil or flaxseed oil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Flaxseed oil, I'll tell you, a good flaxseed oil is Barlin's. That is omega, that is an oil that is definitely organic. Barlin's, Barlean's.
Got it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Flaxseed. It actually has a nice walnut taste to it.
Yeah, it certainly has a history. I mean, the flaxseed, linseed oil has a history that goes back, 10,000 years? And so, you know, in addition to what you that. So just as a small step to the side, a lot of people use coconut oil, which is obviously a saturated fat, to cook. Have you decided not to do that? It's like, you know, I don't need to go that far. I'm good with my olive oil.
Well, let me just tell you. Coconut oil and palm oil.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Were never part of my diet.
Okay.
And I think in countries where they have low sources of animal meat and fat,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have, I would say, olive trees, I think it's perfectly all right. But I don't think that you can use those oils in a Western diet.
Hmm.
Because I don't think they contribute anything.
Hmm. Because they're
and, you know, okay. and you know, this whole idea about terms of the fatty acids,
you know,
the middle chain fatty acids and all that. I really, I'm not that impressed. I frankly feel that those two oils in societies where they have low fat from other sources and lots of vegetables, because they eat a lot of vegetables and fruit, they're doing very well in that particular setup of the diet. But I personally see no reason why I would use coconut oil or palm oil.
That's interesting. Well, the
and if you use them, you're better off to use the fresh press from the fruit and not from the seed, because the one from the seed have a lot of problems.
Right. Can you go one step further and say what are some of the problems with the ones from the seeds?
I think what happens is there are saturated fats.
Yeah,
and it comes from the seeds, and they don't have any of the antioxidants.
Yeah, that's true.
Where the ones that comes from pressing the fruit,
right?
You know, in other words, taking the palm fruit,
right? The red palm,
pressing it.
They call it red palm oil.
You get antioxidants, and you get middle chain fatty acids.
Yep.
You know, which are okay.
Yep,
but. When you take the seeds of the palm and try to get oil out of the seed, you get a lot of trans and you don't have any of the antioxidants.
Hmm. Right.
In general, oils from fruit are high in antioxidants.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good rule of thumb. Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
So...
Thank you for that. That was very good. Because people often, back to the canola thing, they see canola in two ways. One is it's now a GMO and it's a big deal. It used to be speaking of World War II, it used to be the big lubricant, you know? So,
But I'll tell you, the least processed the oil is, the better it is.
Right. For sure. For sure. Absolutely.
And I think as a general rule, oils that coming from fruit, and it's strictly by pressuring the fruit rather than high temperature and high pressure, because under high temperature and pressure they destroy all the antioxidants.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
And that's why extra virgin olive oil gives you such good results.
Right, right.
It's because of its composition being very high in monounsaturates and because of the phenols. In addition to phenols, it also has squalene and other antioxidants. Mm-hmm. Olive oil is very different from all other oils.
In the sense that it's high?
In being high in antioxidants,
phenolics,
in different types of antioxidants, because you don't only have the polyphenols.
Mm-hmm.
But you have special polyphenols like the tyrosols that act like ibuprofen. The taste that you get in olive oil, which is a little bit bitter, or sometimes it might just feel too hot to the tongue, is due to tyrosol, which has a function very similar to ibuprofen. So ideally, if you're going to eat fish, obviously you should marinate it in olive oil. So this way you get twice as much of the beneficial effects.
Great thinking. Thank you. Can I go back to frame what I think is a really important historical chronology context? Because, I'm obviously familiar with the Ansel Keys and all of that and the seven country studies. And then we then had the two studies, or the one studies, or if one's just American, that the McGovern Committee based on, hey, this is what we're going to do. And you were in kind of like the opposite camp by saying, no, that's a stupid thing. That's a stupid, forget about the whole nine yards, even though you called it dietary guidelines. It ended up being the stamp of, it was really a pro-cholesterol thing and get the fatty acids out there. And it was kind of ushered in the whole processed foods. So you had to endure three decades, or arguably four decades. And then you had this guy, Dr. Chris Ramsden, who relooked at the two studies, the Australian and the American, and said, that's actually, they came up with the wrong conclusion. So there's four decades of pharmaceutical industry or conventional medicine. I'm not trying to look for collusion or conspiracy here, that had this conclusion that really wasn't true. And you kind of pretty much knew it from all the research, forget about the studies. You were in the opposite side saying the world's gone crazy. I mean, did you feel like, what the heck? Were you just keeping your fingers?
Don't forget that the people that I thought they were outstanding scientists, like Alex Leaf, at Harvard, he was a statesman. In the 1970s and 80s, he was the number one person. He and I were in total agreement. And in fact, I would say he persisted in the importance of the prostaglandin metabolism and lipid mediators. And that's why Dr. Khan, in his lab, established the one fat mice model,
mm-hmm.
where that particular mice model is given the delta 3 desaturase, the enzyme that mammals are missing, and when you insert it, you take that the delta 3 desaturase has been isolated from C. elegans.
Mm-hmm.
And you take the delta 3 desaturase and you insert into the one fat mouse, and that you feed it the standard diet, chow diet, and the one that has the delta 3 desaturase makes omega-3s from omega-6 and does not stop until they're equal. In other words, if you have a delta C desaturase, no matter what you ate, the end result would be equal amounts of omega-6 and omega-3. You would make ALA from LA. You would make EPA from arachidonic acid. And so this is the best evidence on the fact that human beings, like other mammals, because they got the arachidonic acid and the linoleic and the alpha-linolenic and EPA, because we got it from our diet, we no longer have the delta-3 desaturase. But when we get it, the mammals, when we get it, we make equal amounts of omega-6 and omega-3. Now, I can tell you, the chickens in Greece, under complete natural conditions, they make an egg that has a ratio of 1.3 omega-6 to omega-3. Where the standard USDA egg has a ratio of 19.5 to 1. So I can take you through nature and show it all to you. So I always felt very comfortable, and I just also know, as I explained to you once before, Aristotle said that the search for truth is very important, but not everybody can just conceive it.
Right, right.
So you need to get enough people to see it, and then we rise above that. And right now, I think we have reached the Aristotelian concept. I feel very comfortable about it. And there are study after study after study using that model, the one fat mice model, for various diseases and conditions. In fact, that model, Dr. Khan has given it to laboratories around the world. And then you can even go one step further. You know, the studies by Ramsden that really pointed out it was never the linoleic acid. But most importantly, he just published a study in people with, in women, with migraine headaches, and he used various ratios, and he tried very hard to get the ratio, you know, from the diet, not supplements, from the diet first, to see if he can bring it down to 2 to 1, the lowest he could bring it, even with people who were very cooperative, was 3.5 to 1. In the American culture. And it was able to show that when you lower the ratio, the migraine headaches improve.
Nice.
And that's the latest thing, which I think is fantastic. So I feel pretty good that I stood by the truth.
You did.
But I had a lot of supporters. I could have never done it by myself.
Okay.
I mean, we set up the society, don't forget. There are over 500 members for ISFAL internationally. And we did a series of books on world reviews of nutrition and dietetics that did very well. You know, so I feel that when you know you're on the right track and you have the support of the scientists you respect.
Right.
That's how advances take place.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would still be giving people low cholesterol diets, although some people still do, I suppose.
So let me bring you current now. I mean, I know you know this. I'm just sort of hashing it over a little bit. When Dr. Ramsden decided to relook at these studies for whatever reason, it's interesting. His background was in physical medicine rehabilitation, so it wasn't in you. It wasn't like yours, but nonetheless, he did these two studies separated by what, 3 or 4 years? The Minnesota.
Yeah, 4 years ago he published, but he has been working on that for a long time.
Yeah. No, it wasn't any easy.
I think it's an outstanding piece of work. And it shows, Carl, that you have to be very careful and very accurate and know the composition of your oils at baseline.
Yeah.
and then add the supplementation and measure it at several times. This is not epidemiology. You measure it at the beginning and then you look 20 years later. It's ridiculous.
I agree. Yep.
Yeah. And so I think Ramsden's contribution are enormous. And he proved exactly what we had said. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go to what you sort of referred to a number of times, which is now the whole genetic aspect. So, in my view, it's now easier for both the individual person and certainly the family physician to look into people's genes. And I don't just mean you order the test on LabCorp or Quest, which is what most physicians use, but you now have a number of companies that look at SNPs. You don't have to look at the whole human genome. And it's just exploded, but you were kind of there in the very hard way of looking at, you know, ordering this like one mutation at a time and seeing the relevance. Let's dive into what you think is important about that, because I know you've mentioned one in particular, if you want to jump into that, of the mutations that happen kind of more ethnically. But what do you think about that? That's just a whole piece that now is, it still makes a lot of doctors uneasy about saying genetic variants, you know, these mutation variants. They go, it stops a conversation. You know, we're not going to go there.
I don't know of any physician who does not believe in genetic variation.
Okay.
I mean, really.
Okay.
Genetic variants occur everywhere in plants, animals, birds, mammals, humans. There are genetic variants because that's how adaptation takes place.
Okay.
That's how we survive.
Clearly.
As a species.
Right. Let me be more specific. It's the implementation of. So we all know that as a concept, just kind of like we know the Big Bang Theory started.
Yeah.
Right. It's a concept, but the implementation of, hey, let's go look at your SNPs. Let's go. That's still a extreme minority. And, you know, you reference some in some of your work. It's like, that's a big deal. I mean, that's a big deal for you. And this is very specific. And so I'm looking for the actionable information around that. I think it's very actionable, but I think it's still sort of, at least me in my context of the colleagues that I talk with, it's still like, yeah, that's interesting. But how does it, you know, I'm just not going to be using that on the next patient that comes through unless they have some, you know, way down the line, pretty extreme situation. Bring that forward, you know, in terms of, yes, it's a reality. Yes, it's something that can be analyzed. And yes, it's something that can be...
I mean, look, the journals have defined ethnicity, ancestry. Racism is a social thing. It does not have any biological significance.
Right.
I mean, the American Society of Human Genetics has come out with pronouncements. I agree with the American Society of Human Genetics, as well as JAMA and all these other things. I think it is very important to realize, one, that all of us are different,
right,
despite the fact that we are similar at about 98.6 of our genes. But that 1.4, the difference, consists of many, many alleles or nucleotides,
right,
that have important variants throughout evolution. And those who are, at one time, they were very helpful. Now, with changes in diet and the environment, are becoming detrimental.
Right.
And, or, for example, you know, in Africa or in Egypt, where it first started, mm-hmm, you had a lot of Anopheles mosquito, and malaria was a very serious disease.
Mm-hmm.
And people would die from it. And those who did not die were the people where their hemoglobin was different, their red cell shape was different, and we know it as sickle cell anemia.
Correct.
So so that this came about because of the environment in which people lived. And the most important thing is today to get rid of the mosquitoes, number one. And number two, you can go ahead and through editing, genetic editing, you put in the right gene in the right place and you don't have the sickling. And that's what progress is all about, is not to be afraid of knowing the scientific truth and recognize that every single human has genetic variants that in various circumstances are going to manifest themselves.
Mm-hmm. So let me use an example from your paper. We're talking, this is the one in, looking for the 2020. They're all pretty rich. You're such a powerhouse in terms of your prolific production of all these papers.
Which one are you talking
this,
about?
This is the one, genetic variation on diet, inflammation, and the risk for COVID-19. And I'll just jump down.
Yes. Okay. This is the one on precision nutrition.
It includes that.
That's precision nutrition.
You have another paper.
Genetic variants, resolution, and risk for COVID-19.
Right.
The one that I did with Charlie Sarhan and Bazinet.
That is, I believe so. I don't see.
Okay.
I think what you're thinking about, you have another paper, hard to keep track. The other one that you have, it's called The Need for Precision Nutrition, Genetic Variation. That's, and it also has COVID-19. This is a different paper. This was in the same year, I believe. And
It was published in Molecular Aspects of Medicine.
Right. That's the one that you decided. So the one that I initially referred to is entitled this, Genetic Variation, Diet, Inflammation, and the Risk of COVID-19. That's September 17th, 2020. But it goes into, and the reason I wanted to just bring this up, it goes into some of the SNPs, you know, FADS, FADS, 1-2, and then ELOV, 2 and 5, and saying, you know, it sounds complicated to most people, but you got right into it, you know, and these are SNPs that people can identify in themselves now. Yeah, one of those has I don't mean to bring up ethnicity as a defining thing. It just happened to be in this particular case that it was more in one type than the other, but they're not always that way. So you are into it. I mean, this is a tool that you have had your hands around for a long time, and it seems like it's now coming of age, apart from the whole CRISPR approach of like, let's change people's genes. It's like this kind of awareness is, I think, profound. I mean, you look into it and saying, all right, here we go, Jack. Now we come back with your SNPs. We're not looking your whole genome, but we're looking at maybe the top 220. And of those, what's relevant, maybe the top 4 or 5 that we can, you know, address and saying, this is why this might have something to do with your situation. I think that's amazing. And you've been there for a while already, looking at these things.
NIH in 2018, or 3 years ago, mm-hmm. or almost 4 years ago, established a major program, which is called All of Us, and they're doing genetics and genetic variations.
Mm-hmm.
That's a major program. And then this last April, they established another program called Precision Nutrition. And they're going to combine these two activities and use, for precision nutrition, they are going to use the data from the people in All of Us. So to me, this is 50 years too late, mm-hmm. but I'm glad it's here.
Yeah. Yep.
But we knew an awful lot of that then. And that's why, you know, I did the book Genetic Variation and Nutrition with Barton Childs at the National Academy of Sciences in 89. The conference was in 89. The book was published in 1990. Okay. So it's 31 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But 14 years ago, I established the International Society of Nutrigenetics, Nutrigenomics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the field, I see those two fields. One is the fatty acid and lipids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The International Society for the Study of Fatty Acids and Lipids, which I founded with Dr. Leaf. Back in 1990, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And then the nutrigenetics and nutrigenomics 15 years ago as the two most important fields in medicine to maintain health.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
this is it. I should tell you that I did a book for the educated public, students, physicians, teachers, nutritionists, dietitians, and I hope policymakers. And the title is The Healthiest Diet for You. Not to describe the healthiest diet, but how you're going to know the healthiest diet for you.
Mm-hmm.
Scientific aspects. And that is going to be online either the end of this month or the first week of next year.
Excellent.
And I hope that people will begin to look at the science. I think because of COVID, people are vitally interested in science. They don't want to be told. They want to know. So I wrote the book with the idea for those who want to know.
I love your optimism. I'm with you there. And it is very important. And I do absolutely believe it's the most important. Nutrigenomics, absolutely. You know, this has to be the lingua franca of colleagues and physicians and health practitioners talking to each other. It's the bread and butter. I mean, it has to be identified on a per patient basis, but it's actionable information. It's not esoteric. That's what I'm trying to get out, you know, and you already know that. I mean, you've been in the trenches for a while. So it's no news to you, but it's news to the general public. You know, their eyes get glazed over until you make it relevant to them and say, these are things we can look at.
Well, I think this concepts are fundamental concepts that I think students should learn in high school, you know?
Mm. Here's hoping. I think so. So, right. So you did have your precision nutrition. Let me just get that up. I want to come back to, yeah. So that was the need for precision nutrition, genetic variation, and the resolution of COVID-19 patients. So scientifically, the foundations are what we've been talking about. At the same time, it's kind of controversial in this era of COVID. And I'm so thankful that you brought it out there, because it just says, let's just get the information out there. And, you know, so much stuff is blocked and so on and so forth. Not to go there. But I also want to say that, as you told me, you have a paper that was a little before those, was in 2016, an increase in omega-6-3 fatty acid ratio increases the risk for obesity. So that was,
yeah.
And that was on PubMed. And what happened? What happened about that paper? All right. It was the most downloaded paper ever in that subsequent year of 2017.
Yes.
Yes. Right. That's impressive. That's beyond award giving. That's like, this is the worldwide.
That continues. There are about 3-4 other papers that relate to that continue to be downloaded. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Can you, other than that acknowledgement, can you go into that? Because, you know, people who listen to this, and this is what this is like trying to make this actionable information, and most people don't know that. We're still, I know we've just talked about Crete and so on and so forth. We went through their food that they had and how that was not in the Ansel Keys, and he cherry picked and avoided that. And he went and said, no, it's similar to Japan because the omega-3s and so on. If you were to say, obesity in the United States. You know, we tend to have a prize in this country more so than other countries. If you ask me, we were the first to get the fattest. You know, we are there. You know, and there we have a ratio of chronic disease is 60% population wide, regardless of age. I mean, that I think it's very associated. Would you say it all comes down to the ratio, or am I being, you know, and sort of leading into that paper so people go online and download it for themselves and don't feel they have to be a scientist to understand it?
Yeah, because you change the cell membrane. And the cell membranes are the ones that more or less communicate. They're like connections between cells is through their cell membranes. The receptors are on the cell membranes. Everything that goes in and out of the cell has to go through the cell membrane. And that's why the fatty acids are so very important, because they are more or less the largest proportion of any other element on the membranes of the cells.
Got it.
They more or less define the function of the cell membrane. You know?
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's a great way of saying it.
But it's not very easy to study. I remember when people tried to do this type of studies on an individual cell, but now you can do a single cell at a time. Maybe they will be able to find out a much better way. But there is no question that the fatty acids are the most important components of cell membranes when it comes to cell-to-cell communication and metabolism, you know,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right, about that.
I
should tell you, because you mentioned that paper on the precision nutrition and risk to COVID-19.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you know that the editor sent me a letter saying that they always follow the downloading of the papers for the first 90 days.
Yeah.
And that paper had the highest number of any other paper, not only for the others, for the 90 days.
Yeah. Wow.
So the impact of that paper, I have the letter from the editor, and because I really didn't expect, you know.
Yeah.
But I think I am convinced that now is the time to get these concepts out there. And that's why I really did the book.
Yep. Yep.
For the educated public.
Yeah.
The people who want to know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That is a good differentiator. Can I take a step in a direction that I didn't describe? That is, you know, so you're obviously into the epigenetics and the nutrigenomics, of course. And speaking of fat mice, you know, back in, 2003, that Randy Jertl and his whole Goody Mouse situation, you know, it just gave methylation factors and it, you know, the subsequent generation were all normal and they're no longer, you know, have you ever thought of something similar relative to fatty acids and the interconnection between the two? Or saying, well, of course, they've always been connected, but it was such a simple experiment that it sort of shook up the world to suddenly become epigenetic focus, which is what you'd been focused on anyway, you know, before everybody else got there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
yeah, go ahead.
You know, Waldman described epigenetics in the 40s. This is not a new concept.
No, no.
But people, what epigenetics is, it tells you something about the mechanism by which the gene influences or is influenced by for its expression.
Right.
Because there are substances that will change the order, but not the structure of the DNA.
Right.
You know, you add a methyl group and you stop the expression of the gene.
Right, right.
And so these are all, I think, deal more with mechanisms. I frankly feel that this is a very exciting area,
mm-hmm.
because you hope to be able to understand what influences the expression of the gene and try to modify it before it produces any harm. And I think the future is in understanding the mechanisms of methylation or chromatin right. and all these other
right,
mechanisms. But that, I think it will take time. But we know a lot more about how the environment, and particularly food, and any deviation on foods that we're using that were not part of our evolution,
mm-hmm.
are going to create difficulties, the same way that the very high amounts of omega-6 fatty acids have created mm-hmm. for the chronic diseases right now.
Right. Absolutely. No, absolutely. Do you think the whole era since World War II, I mean, I look at the kind of the beginning of epigenetics was the whole Dutch winter hunger crisis and some of the data that came out of there, but there's other, you know, areas that generated that whole thing. But do you see now this whole, you know, pharmaceutical industry is now a mammoth and never really existed then? We have, what else is there? We have sort of oppositional financial groups. It makes it harder for good science. I'm not whining here. I'm just saying that they didn't exist before. And so things like epigenetics and saying, why not look at one methylation's pattern for, I don't know, it's cancer or any particular condition. And we can address that, where the word is kind of like muddled now, because there's a lot of money on the other side. That if you can take, I'm not even just talking about supplements, if you can eat your way to health, hey, there's an idea. You know, why do you need medications? I mean, do you sort of see that sort of oppositional, or are you saying, hey, you know, it's just there, it will change in time because look at all the downloads.
No, I don't think it's oppositional. I think you should try to get as much information as possible about what causes disease. And I think you should separate associations from causation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think science policies should be made on the best possible data as to what causes something, not what is associated with. Mm-hmm. And anything that will help to understand a cause and effect, whether it is through epigenetics or whether it is through understanding the evolutionary aspects of diet, is going to be very important. I think before you begin to create foods that have not been part of our diet,
mm-hmm.
we ought to have very good studies that they were not doing any harm. Remember, first, do no harm.
How Greek.
just to, I would say, quote Hippocrates.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I should stop now because Mary is waiting
okay.
for me
I appreciate
to
that.
Finish up things.
Okay.
I think you have enough to do any book,
absolutely.
You know, to pick up anything you want from the podcast.
You bet. Thank you very much for your time. I so appreciate
You're
it.
You're very welcome.
And all your work.
You're very welcome.
Take care, Artemis.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp again for a brief reminder of something I completely forget to do at the end of every episode. You've heard me talk long enough in many different episodes, but what I would love you to do, and many of you have already done this, I just want to reinforce this particular behavior, which is to send me your questions. Send me your questions on anything you have about keto. If there's something that I don't know, I will look it up. And if it's something that intrigues me, I will probably make an episode, a podcast about that particular topic. So what you need to do is to send me your questions at drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. So that's drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. Feel free to join our Facebook group, which is also ketonaturopath.com. That's been growing lately. You also have to answer a questionnaire should you choose to join. And I don't ask for your email. I ask that you follow our terms. I try to avoid
advertising and the obvious interruptions of just a good Facebook group. So hope to see you at one place or other. Please send me your questions and look forward to talking to you and getting to know you. Take care.